Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Finally, the impeachment fat is in the fire. It's a smaller fire than it might have been. A short bill of just two particulars. That President Trump tried to shake down Ukraine for help in Trump's own re-election campaign in 2020. Also, that he had stonewalled Congress's investigation. It is nothing like a frontal attack on the Trump presidency, on his climate denial, say, or breaking the anti-nuclear deal with Iran, or profiteering on public office, or cruelty to migrants at the border. In the week's news of the American empire as a whole, it could seem a lesser story than the Pentagon's confession about our 18-year, $2 trillion losing war in Afghanistan that, in one top general's words, we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking. One of our guests this radio hour, the retired Army colonel and critic Andrew Bacevich, responded to the news about Afghanistan this week with a headline on the Atlantic website, said, "If Ukraine is impeachable, what's Afghanistan?" And he's not defending Donald Trump either. Noah Feldman gets our conversation started on impeachment, the text and the context. He's a Harvard law professor, one of three constitutional law professors who told the House committee last week that President Trump muscling Ukraine for dirt on Joe Biden was just the sort of abuse that the framers wanted to punish by impeachment. Welcome. Welcome back, Noah Feldman. Did anybody make a strong argument against you?
Well, I don't think that Professor Jonathan Turley's arguments on the other side are very strong, mostly because he conceded that if the president did do the things that he's alleged to have done, that that would be impeachable. He just claimed to deny that there was enough evidence for it, which I think basically is preposterous because, you know, you just have to look at the memorandum of the phone call, and there Trump is doing it. So, no, I don't actually think the arguments on the other side are very strong at all.
I wondered, is two articles in the bill of impeachment enough? I mean, so much to choose from.
There is a lot to choose from. It's important to remember that the fact that some conduct is impeachable doesn't mean that Congress should make the decision to impeach for it. It's like a prosecutor. The prosecutor has to choose those charges which are most likely to stick with the jury and which are most germane and significant, and there may be other criminal conduct that the prosecutor passes over. And in this instance, it seems to me that it was a wise decision to stick with these two specific offenses because they're just in your face. They don't require a lot of proof. They don't require a complex legal or constitutional argument. The president abused his power to get himself reelected for personal benefit and gain to the detriment of our national security interest. Boom, that's one. The president stonewalled Congress and thereby denied the right of Congress to impeach him. Ultimately, that means he's above the law. That's obstruction of Congress. Boom, that's the second. And to my mind, you know, that's the whole case, and it's a powerful case, and it spares us a long debate about was there a quid pro quo, what is the legal definition of bribery, you know, is a certain policy wise or unwise. Those are not the relevant questions to my mind when it comes to an actual impeachment of the president.
What's the closest thing to a good Republican argument on the contrary?
I think the strongest argument that they have is that without a clear and specified legal definition of what a high crime and misdemeanor might be, it seems a little unfair to punish the president for doing something where he basically seems to have thought it was fine. Now, to be clear, I think that argument can be refuted. I think that argument is wrong. I think that it's all the time the case that we sanction people for doing something that is obviously morally wrong. And it's obviously morally wrong for the president to use his special powers of office to try to corrupt the election process and get special benefits for himself. Anyone would know that. So I don't think the argument is a very good argument on the other side, but it's the best they've got and they're going with it.
No, I've heard you say that the law on impeachment of a president, high crimes, misdemeanors, is all pretty straightforward. It's the politics that is, if not inscrutable, tends to the chaotic. What did you learn there in the viper's nest, so to speak?
Well, what I learned is that when you go into a very political process, and impeachment is necessarily political in the sense that it's done by Congress, which is the political branch of government, you have to decide when you go in, what are you going to try to accomplish? And what I thought I might be able to do is just to state really simply and crisply why the framers actually put impeachment in the Constitution and what high crimes and misdemeanors are and why the president's conduct, if you believe that he did it, violated those basic principles. So I just tried to keep it super simple because around you, everybody on all sides is trying to complexify it for political gain. And so I thought if I'm going to come out of that viper's nest alive, I want to know that I stayed on this clear message. And part of the upshot of that is I repeated myself a lot of times, which is not my preference. It's kind of boring for an audience who sits there the whole time. But no, luckily for me, nobody actually listened to a full 9 hours of testimony.
You can tell the whole story now if you like. But I'm also just wondering, shouldn't there have been more and more grandeur, if I may say, in this charge against the President of the United States?
Well, what counts as grandeur in your mind, Chris? I mean, to me, we'll stating that the president abused his office, abused the powers of the presidency for personal gain, that's pretty bad. And he did it in an ungrand kind of way. And so the charge is a bit ungrand. You know, I mean, the way I like to think about this is, you know, in the good old days, Richard Nixon's campaign sent burglars to break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters because, you know, you wanted to put some distance between yourself and, you know, bad acts like that. But President Trump just got on the phone and called the president of Ukraine with the whole world practically listening. I mean, certainly lots of staff and other people, and just flat out tried to break the election. So, you know, times have changed. I mean, we no longer have the clever, dirty tricks. It's now right up on the surface.
Times have changed. First, the gold standard of grandeur in an impeachment case is Edmund Burke against Warren Hastings of the East India Company in British Parliament in, I think it was 1788, and David Bromwich knows the whole story. We'll get to that. But what's the intermediate point? Simply that the world is just full of critical problems. Climate, number one, two, three, four, and seven, but also every kind of cosmic threat. This seems a little local.
Well, okay. So two responses to that, Chris. First, I'm very much looking forward to talking about the impeachment of Warren Hastings, the former Governor General of Bengal, with the great David Bromwich. That'll be a personal thrill for me. And I've spent
too.
A lot of time deep in the Hastings papers. And I will just say in advance, actually, you know, Burke was an amazing orator, but it was a 7-year process and it wasn't that grand. If you work your way through the articles of impeachment, they're basically case by case by case charges of bribery and in one case of breaking the justice system.
Well, the grandeur
came
in.
I don't think it was actually Burke was grand, and we have no Burke today. But the charges against Hastings weren't that grand. And then the second thing—
Let me just say, the rhetoric was incredibly grand. I impeach Hastings in the name of the people of India, in the name of the Commons of Great Britain, in the name of those eternal laws of justice which he has violated, in the name of human nature itself, which he has cruelly outraged, injured, and oppressed in both sexes, blah, blah, blah. I mean,
Burke was one of the great writers of all time, and there's no question that that's a heck of a speech. So I'm not impugning his literary rhetorical capacity in any way, shape, or form. What I am saying, though, about our current world, where, as you say, there are lots of things to be angry at the president for, is that we ought to distinguish between policy disagreements, where we think the president has done a terrible, terrible job, and where we think that he's gotten it all wrong, and situations where we think that the president has committed high crimes and misdemeanors by abusing his office for personal gain. There's a big difference between those things. And even in the Constitutional Convention, this topic arose. You know, George Mason, who was very, very committed, he was this great, staunch, anti-government Republican from Virginia, and he proposed language that would define high crimes and misdemeanors in terms of, quote, maladministration. Now, he took that term from the legal thinker William Blackstone. He didn't make it up out of whole cloth, and it actually was the definition of high misdemeanor in Blackstone's writing. But James Madison, who was not a lawyer and had a more generalist's ear, heard the phrase maladministration and said, that's too vague. If we put that in the Constitution, that means the president serves at the pleasure of the House and the Senate, and he can be removed for any old thing. And he insisted on something stronger, and so they came back Mason came back with high crimes and misdemeanors.
And
to me, the reason that matters is just to finish the thought, Chris, what it means is that disagreement with policy, even terrible policy decisions, are not themselves impeachable.
I just want to kick the tires of the particulars. I mean, 21 years ago, almost exactly this week, Bill Clinton, a lot of people in the Republican House thought Bill Clinton should be impeached for lying about sex. I don't think that would happen again. If the world chokes on its own carbon and dies, we will be indicted, all of us, for ignoring the danger to our precious planet in the climate. I didn't hear sort of rising to that point. But let me another question for you and what the framers intended. I wonder if they wanted a lot more impeachment. I think you could make a case for weekly impeachment. Mr. President, you screwed up on this, or you haven't followed our thoughts on that, and or make it a quarterly, or act like an aggressive board of directors with a corporate CEO. Check up all the time. What would the framers
The framers did anticipate a far more active and engaged Congress than we have. I mean, the reason the Constitution starts with Article 1 about Congress is they were convinced that it was by far the most important branch of the government, with the executive a fairly distant second and the Supreme Court a not even talkaboutable third. So they definitely expected a much more powerful, engaged legislature, and they never anticipated the gradual – well, they anticipated but feared and did not approve of the idea of the gradual accrual of greater and greater power in the presidency. However, and it's a big however, it doesn't follow from that Congress should be constantly impeaching the president. It follows that Congress should be withholding funds from things the president wants to do. It should be passing laws that restrict and limit what the president can do. It should be
doing a lot to roll back
our executive power.
What about plain censure?
Could,
a whole list
you
of...
could censure sometimes, too. There might be circumstances where it's necessary to censure, too. But I don't think that that's really the same as impeachment, which should really be preserved for genuine abuses of the office.
Noah, stand by. I mean, the larger question that I know we'll come back to is whether the framers' language is adequate to our times. We're a huge, imperial, overstretched nation, and we're going to take it up when we come back. If permanent war, for example, is a crime, who's to be impeached? This is Open Source. It's impeachment time. And speaking of abuse of power in the executive branch, the Washington Post had a serious scoop from the other side of the Potomac River this week. It was another Inspector General's report on 400 interviews with major players in the U.S. war in Afghanistan. The sum of it was those years of rosy hype, routine claims of progress were a calculated deception, a self-licking ice cream cone, said one Army officer, to cover a $2 trillion mistake. The retired Army officer that we know best, Andrew Basevich, joins us. He's a veteran of Vietnam and Gulf Wars, and he's now a prolific book-writing critic of military thinking and performance. Andy, you commented Tuesday on the Atlantic website, if Ukraine is impeachable, what's Afghanistan? You said, a misguided war that drags on inconclusively for more than 18 years is, I submit, a great crime. And you weren't trying to take Donald Trump off the hook for anything. Just what did you mean? Do you really mean it ought to be pursued as at least malfeasance?
Well, I guess sort of where I am in this moment when the impeachment story dominates the news, dominates the national conversation, I think it would be useful to pause and ask ourselves what our aim is. I think Trump is a vulgar narcissist. He's dishonest. He's a lout. He shouldn't be president. No question about that. But what are we trying to achieve? It seems to me that Trump's most ardent critics act on the belief that if he can be purged from our politics, that all will be well. And I've come to believe that that's not the case. It seems to me that the aim, our aim, ought to be at this point to figure out how to fix our broken politics, to somehow find a way to repair the divisions in our country that gave us Trump in the first place. Now, I don't know how the impeachment process is going to pan out. It seems almost inevitable that he will indeed be impeached. It seems, if not inevitable, close to inevitable, that he will not be convicted in the Senate. And so I ask myself, well, where will that lead us? I mean, setting aside all partisan questions, where will that leave the country? And I fear that where it will leave the country is even more deeply divided than we were before the impeachment process began.
Well, it's going to take us into an election.
I can't think that that's good.
But there we do vote in November next year. I like your impulse to take it to a larger or to a higher question. What is up here? I would say the larger mission, as I view it, is to rescue the rule of law, for one thing, but also to restore popular confidence in our own democracy, as if we were the sovereign people.
Okay.
And how
but,
do we get
but,
there?
But, and this is where I think the Afghanistan war revelations are so pertinent, that would require a candid acknowledgement of the failures on the part of our government, not failures since Trump became president, but failures over the past 20 or 30 years with our misguided and wasteful wars as a classic example of that. So we've got a governing class which is all up in arms about Trump's crimes, and they are crimes, I have no doubt about that, and yet we have a governing class that would appear to be oblivious to this longest war in our history that people have lied about, that are oblivious to the consequences of the misguided and illegal Iraq war, that treat climate change, you've already mentioned that a couple times, that treat climate change as an afterthought. So I think the question is, you know, in stacking up crimes, you know, how great indeed are the crimes that Trump is accused of? And my answer is not nearly as great as other matters that our governing class tends to want to ignore.
And the Afghanistan connection to our politics, Andy, I think is also clear. It's intuitively clear, but it's documented that in those swing states of the northern Midwest, the counties that supported Trump that might not have were the ones most addicted, most bereft, most affected by the casualties in those Middle East wars, Iraq and Afghanistan specifically. That's where the election turned. It's well argued. So all of this is in one great bag. I'd like to introduce David Bromwich, who Noah Feldman already has, in a sense. He joins us from New Haven. He's the Sterling Professor of English at Yale, and he's my model of close reading, both the daily papers as well as the best old books. How Words Make Things Happen is one of David Bromwich's many books. American Breakdown is his latest. I don't know if you hold up on Edmund Burke for a moment, David Bromwich, and just read in your style the Inspector General's report on the crucial issues of interference in the Trump campaign in 2016, or reading the Trump campaign.
Thanks, Chris, and I can stay away from Burke as long as you like, contrary to rumor.
No, it's important.
You know, I think the Inspector General's report is very convincing and, unfortunately, doesn't leave the sharp picture that the Democrats and all of us who think Trump deserves to be impeached would have wished it to leave. It tends to bring closer together the actions of the Clinton campaign and, you know, Fusion GPS and the FBI agents who were working too early, too fervently to single-mindedly and cutting some corners in order to try to find what Trump was doing wrong with the Russians in 2016. Brings that too close to what it seems Trump was doing in making that call to Zelensky and essentially saying, find out the things that I believe have been done wrong by my likely rival in 2020. To me, they aren't in the same category. One is really an overt, efficient act by a man who is president. The other is something done by agents within the Federal Bureau of Investigation, perhaps with some tacit contact or understanding with people in the Clinton campaign, but that doesn't really matter. They're not the same.
But David, hang on just one sec. The story of what the IG found, the Inspector General found, looking at the FBI, it has changed even this week. I mean, on Tuesday, the New York Times headline said that he had debunked Trump's suspicion that he'd been spied on. But today's New York Times is quite contrary. It led with the same Inspector General's testimony that the FBI's performance was grossly incompetent and that it vindicated nobody. So is there not a kind of case against Trump's case against how he was treated by Intel agencies in 2016?
Well, by Intel agencies and, as his helper, William Barr, has been saying, fanned by the media, including the liberal corporate media, of which the Times stands at the head. So those two stories today, by one of them by Charlie Savage and the other by Savage in combination with Adam Goldman, were honest stories reflecting the testimony that I saw yesterday. The story that they had as a preview to the IG testimony before Congress was inaccurate. It was a hopeful story. It went along with James Comey's tweet saying this is vindication, and you had Horowitz saying yesterday outright it vindicates no one. So, I mean, I think the media have been anti-Trump. They've been anti-Trump since before the election, but it really gathered force somewhere around mid-2017. And the feeling that they were massed together trying to show him the door almost before he got himself comfortable in the West Wing, I mean, there's truth to that. At the same time, Trump has shown himself by almost every act, every deviation, every, you know, falling on his face and then getting up and sending a tweet about it, has shown himself to be deeply unqualified to be president. And the causes they're giving for impeachment are understandable and, it seems to me, well-taken causes. But you are right that much worse things have been done by him. And it's as if, for example, the pardon he gave to a war criminal, Edward Gallagher, the way he has intervened in the military so as to encourage brutality, what he did in moving those 5,000 troops to the southern border to pump up his election hopes in 2018 to, you know, make as if the border is being invaded, so we need the army. These things are on a larger scale than anything that's in the impeachment right now. But the obstruction of Congress does seem to be major, does seem to me to have Burkean parliamentary proportions. Here is a man who, as the Democrats keep saying, puts himself above the rule of law, and the rule of law is the legislative branch. Congress who stand for us as the lawmakers, and Trump acts in defiance of Congress just as he acts in defiance of the law wherever possible. That is, his strategy, taught to him by Roy Cohn, has been all along throughout his career, and he's continued it as president, has been to take it to the courts, tie it up in the courts, and then, because of his financial resources, outspend his enemies. His enemies now are the U.S. government, and he just intends to outlast them and outspend them. And
I want to interrupt you with two points about media. First, the upper crust elite corporate media, specifically the Times, has been just enormously hostile to Trump in the campaign and since. But the media surround in general, including Twitter media and other media, has been an enormously fruitful ground and fertile ground for Trump. So it works several ways.
He commandeers it. But he's in charge of the Twitter media.
But at the top level, the other thing that's striking, and you've written about it from the beginning, is that the quality media is fed month in, month out by the intel agencies. You wrote in the London Review of Books, and again in your new book, American Breakdown, quote, "The age of detesting Trump is the age of reliance on the deep state and trust in the so-called intelligence community, what other people regard as a sort of coup by the intel piece of our world in our politics, in our mind space." Spell that out. Is that...
Well, that's a perception or an insight other people have had. It seems to me that the worry about the deep state was a libertarian, and there were left-wing as well as right-wing libertarians calling attention to this, Mike Lee being an example of a right-wing libertarian, and Noam Chomsky or Glenn Greenwald, if you like, of left-wing. These people, when the NSA revelations came out after Snowden, were, you know, on the march against the consequences of the Patriot Act and the kind of force in our politics that it was clear the CIA, the NSA, the hugely expanded national security network was beginning to have. That was a Democratic Party cause to the extent that it was aligned with one party. And you had writers like Mike Lofgren and Michael Glennon in what is that book called, National Security and Double Government, or something, talking about the deep state. That's where I picked up the phrase, the deep state. But it's now migrated over to the Republicans because they see that these agencies, bureaus, et cetera, the FBI and so on, are lined up against them. So you have the very strange situation of the Democrats wanting the secret intelligence services to do everything they can in the cause of getting Trump out the door. And that seems to me a very, very dangerous argument, a dangerous stance for them to be taking.
I want to get Noah Feldman's comment on all of that. But first, just coach him a little bit about how Edmund Burke might have toned up the impeachment, the bill of impeachment against Trump.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit with Noah Feldman in his understanding of how difficult it is for us to have grandeur such as the 18th century had. And even then, he's right. You know, this impeachment process that Burke led, and he was the only one who stayed with it all the way. Sheridan, Fox, all the other initial managers more or less deserted him and evaporated in effect. But it lasted 7 years when England had a lot of other business to do. The Regency crisis of 1788-89, response to the French Revolution, and so on. 137 days in Parliament overall were spent on the impeachment in that seven-year process. So they weren't talking about it every day or every other day. Burke's denunciation of the Governor General of Bengal, Warren Hastings, is very memorable, very grand, and it comes from the consciousness of responsibility towards mankind. Why? Because Burke and the British at that time conceived of themselves as an empire, just as Rome, when Cicero made his Contra Veres speeches against a corrupt African governor, Rome conceived of itself as an empire too. But don't think of ourselves as an empire, and so crimes such as we committed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on, don't strike us as being what our Constitution is about. I mean, Burke says about Parliament's duties towards India that by their distance, they have a double demand on your protection. By their distance, they have a double demand on your protection. But when we talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, all the disasters we've been involved in, we're always talking about American casualties. It's
true,
very
true,
rare
true.
To
but
find
that's also why it, the whole business troubles Andy Bacevich so much.
And I agree, and I think that the responsibility that goes with being that widely extended over the world should be a responsibility toward the world. But I'm not an empire fan. I think it is imperialist in essence to think that you have to have a foreign policy toward every country in the world. It's just wrong. And I don't think the U.S. Constitution is going to begin to go back to what it was meant to be until we pull back from these commitments. And that means that people like As long as we have them, though, Condi Rice can't have a career anymore. Those are careers that are over because of climate change, because of the kind of international situation which requires international controls that have nothing to do with making war and nothing to do with spreading democracy.
But the Washington Post piece, and I think Andy Bacevich's comment, assumes that as long as we have that power and exercise it, we also better have a standard of justice for the people we're lording it over. I think it's Noah Feldman's turn to leap in.
Well, tell me which of the many threads you want me to leap in on, Chris.
One.
I mean, so let's start with the deep state. I think, you know, David is right that there are some Democrats who want, and you may be right, Chris, too, that there are some Democrats who want the intelligence community to somehow participate in bringing down Trump, or who are, you know, happy, ironically, that it was a CIA officer who blew the whistle on the phone call. But actually, you know, a lot of the right-wing critique of the deep state is misplaced. It's aimed at people like the ones we've heard testifying against Trump in the House, people like Ambassador Bill Taylor, who are essentially career public servants. You know, Taylor started his career at West Point. He worked in a range of different executive branch jobs. He ended up in the State Department. He served as a career officer with distinction. He was not especially political, and if he had any political leanings, they were Republican. And he just couldn't believe the outrage of the president of the United States hijacking the foreign policy of the United States to serve his personal interests. Now, that's a pretty moving line, and it doesn't require a person to be part of a deep state. It's just someone who actually is a public servant and cares about our country. So I think there's a lot of that out there, too.
We will get back to all of that. I don't know that I've got time for a David Brumwich comment there or Andy Bacevich either, but we'll come back to as much as we can. Coming up, there is a pounding emotional pulse under this impeachment fight, as strong as it was, oddly enough, under the, it seems silly now, Bill Clinton impeachment fight. But what is the mood? This is Open Source. Who wants to review the mood of this season, the air of anger? Some say madness. Here's the law professor, Jonathan Turley, before the impeachment committee.
I get it. You're mad. The president's mad. My Republican friends are mad. My Democratic friends are mad. My wife is mad. My kids are mad. Even my dog seems mad. And Luna's a golden doodle, and they don't get mad. So we're all mad. Where's that taking us? Will a slipshod impeachment make us less mad? Will it only invite an invitation for the madness to follow every future administration? That is why this is wrong.
The climate denier in the White House has to be angry that Greta Thunberg, Swedish teenager, will be Time Magazine's Person of the Year for her "How Dare You" call at the UN to save Mother Nature. But Trump says she's got the anger problem, and he tells her to chill, Greta, chill, go see a movie. Nancy Pelosi, meantime, wanted to make it clear that she does not hate the president.
This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office. And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time.
No anger. Noah Feldman, you were there in the anger. Can you sort it out? Compare it to, for example, the Clinton time.
Sure. Yeah, I can say something about it. The first thing I would say is, you know, Professor Turley's line is clever, but it's also, you have to remember that he was using that line to argue that the president should be able to get away with violating the Constitution. And that's fundamentally mistaken. You know, it's possible to enforce the law without anger, and it's possible to have the view that if the president breaks the Constitution, then the president should be removed from office without hatred, without anger, and without rage. And I think that was actually the view expressed by the witnesses on the other side. And the cleverness about the bit about the dog, it's always a dog, you know, was designed and did to some extent deflect attention. Now, were people equally up in arms in some way about the Clinton impeachment? Yes, I think in some important ways the Clinton impeachment taught the Republicans today crucial lessons about how they ought to respond to charges. They should say it's irrelevant. They should say it's insignificant. And they should embrace, you know, the strong partisanship of the moment and just go for it. And I think they are, to some extent, following a script drawn from the era of Clinton. So the partisanship that we see today is not new. It was present in certain respects in the time of the Clinton impeachment. And it was also present in earlier periods in U.S. history, you know, most terrifyingly in the run-up to the Civil War, but also, you know, shortly after the Constitution was ratified in the middle 1790s, when the first major national political parties came into existence in the United States, people hated each other every bit as much as we hate each other now. And they didn't have television networks, but they had competing newspapers that went after each other, and they had personal attacks. So the hatred is something that's present in partisanship, and it tends to recur at different moments in our history. And then it generally tends to fade away again after that. Doesn't mean it will happen this time, but the probability is that it will.
Andy Bacevich, you think it's something new and particular, and it is fundamentally resentful of our imperial role. Spell it out. Where do you hear it, see it, measure it?
Well, the last thing I want to do is to sound like I'm a Trump apologist, which I am not, and I'll be as happy as anybody else when he disappears from our political life. But it does seem to me that the impeachment effort is the ultimate expression of a conviction widely held, particularly among, if I can use the term, members of our elite, a conviction that Trump is an illegitimate president, that his ascent to the presidency was an affront, and the anti-Trumpers have been determined to evict him from office since before he took office, and that effort has now reached this moment when we're in the middle of this impeachment process. My view would be that, and furthermore, that there is a belief that if he can be removed from office, he probably won't, but if he could be removed from office, that somehow things would be fixed and we would return to normalcy. I think that's mistaken. I think that Trump's ascent to the presidency is an expression of deep dysfunction and deep division in our country. Those are the problems, not Trump, and that indeed the result of impeachment, the impeachment effort, is likely to increase those divisions, deepen those divisions. Therefore, we'll be that much further away from actually correcting the problem that the Trump presidency expresses. And that's why I think that this entire escapade, emphasizing what an incompetent lout he is, that the impeachment process, I think, is likely to be deeply counterproductive in terms of serving the interests of the nation.
David Bromwich, I wonder how you read that, and again, connect it to Burke. I think there's a broad spirit out there, and it includes a lot of the elite as well as the people, that the country has lost its way. And the empire overstretch has everything to do with it. But your take, please.
Well, Burke was always willing to fight a losing cause. He did that in his first years of opposition to the French Revolution, and he did it through the 7 years of the India impeachment. I think there's a contrast, and that's what Andy Bacevich was getting at just now, between the political effects of the impeachment, what they are likely to be, and the constitutional duty to impeach a president who's done the things Trump has done, including his defiance of Congress, his setting himself above the law, and his wanting to get information that will, weaken the chances of a political opponent from a foreign country. The constitutional duty is you have to stop this man, and the means afforded you for stopping him are included in impeachment. But politically, pragmatically, and consequentially, I agree with Bacevich that the situation, the mood of the country, that bathetic statement about the poor dog who is even hating people, the mood of the country is not going to be better for this. But I'm not sure what would have made it better any time starting around mid-2016, when you had Trump leading crowds in the chant of lock her up, and the Democrats, you know, as soon as Trump was elected, saying things like what Aaron Sorkin said, I think, in a blog the day after, you know, Trump is a douche. And now Trump calls the Democrats scum. And, you know, this is part of our politics, but it now seems to have escalated that it's the main part of our politics. I think Trump, who is crazy and shameless, has a unique power to make other people crazy. And the Democrats, many of them, have seemed, and their allies and the resistance, so-called, have seemed insensate in their attitude toward Trump. And their effort to delegitimate him from the beginning has no real precedent in our politics either. I mean, there was a member of what I'll call the permanent establishment, whom I'm reasonably close to, who told me on the phone, you know, a few days after Trump was elected, how long do you give this guy before he's out the door? 6 months? I think it might be even less, he said. And I thought, how can you be so sure? How can you be so sure? So, you know, I do think the polarization will be heightened by the impeachment, but I'm not sure that Nancy Pelosi had an alternative given what she knew.
Can I ask David a question?
Please. No, if I guess Andy. Andy.
My question would be to David, you know, what would you recommend to a person of goodwill, member of Congress, a member of the Senate, who recognized the problem as you have described it, and would want to actually, in the wake of impeachment, do something useful to actually address our problem?
I think the closest example we've had of such a person has been Nancy Pelosi. I would say Adam Schiff has not been such a person. And, you know, the way is to go along with this president, bad and unqualified and unfit though he is, where possible, and not start calling names against his daughter or his wife, when his daughter and his wife were the main instruments for trying to soften his policy against caging the people who crossed the border. Don't take after everything that Trump is allied with and thus antagonize not only him, but his followers. When he's wrong, say he's wrong. Oppose him with all your heart. But, you know, don't try to delegitimate every hour of every day, both because it's wrong, it increases the mutual hatred, but also because it's not going to work.
And Andy?
That makes sense to me.
I mean, it's your turn, Noah.
I must say, my reaction to Nancy Pelosi's, you know, I don't hate anybody, remark was I thought it was contrived.
It's also
but if
very
I take
Catholic.
Her, if I take her at her word, then that's correct. That is a point of departure that could ultimately lead toward some amount of healing our division. So we do share a basic humanity.
I thought it was home training showing up. The Baltimore family, the Dulles Aldo family of long ago, not that long ago, but it is a different order of values. And I think she was speaking quite from her little girl Catholic heart. But Noah Feldman, it's your turn.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, this goes back to Andy Bacevich's earlier point. I actually think that there are genuine divisions in the country because there are genuine differences of opinion. And those have to do with the place of the United States in the world and whether it ought to give up on the imperial ambitions that came in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. I mean, they were there before then, but they really came out in a big way, as Andy would like us to do, give up on those, or whether and have a different approach. Or alternatively, you know, whether there's, in fact, global stewardship that's crucial and global leadership that's crucial from the United States, especially on issues like climate change, that may actually involve nonviolent intervention, but nevertheless taking the kind of global leadership position that necessarily requires being prepared to use force under some circumstances. I also think people are divided about trade and whether, you know, whether it should be morally significant that people in China have gotten to be better off, or whether that should be outweighed by the fact that people in the United States have come to be worse off. I think people are deeply divided on social issues. So I think we have disagreements in this country, and we have division because there's genuine disagreement. Now, of course, I would prefer that disagreement not be expressed through a populist violence, but at the same time, I think we have to be respectful of the substantive content of our political disagreements and not just wave our hands and say, unity, unity, unity. You know, there's lots not to be united about. There are genuine, fundamental, substantive disagreements on national policy, on foreign policy, and on moral values.
No, I think the world would love us to lead on climate change, but abandon these wars, notably Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, I just want to say back to Burke. Can I give you, go back to Burke for one sec? He stands tall in history because he didn't hesitate in the 18th century to upbraid the management of the empire in India. And to talk about its cruelty, its greed, its rapacity, and bet on the fact that, as he believed, all that stuff had dishonored the British character. I think a lot of Americans feel this.
As David Bromwich just rather brilliantly and correctly pointed out, he did so because he understood himself as an Englishman, as having a trust duty towards people in India who were going to be governed by England. And the idea was, well, if we're going to govern as an empire, then we have a moral responsibility or duty to people who are, you know, Burke himself didn't say that they were lesser, but that's part of the same general conception. So I think it's nice to say that we should be a global leader and liberally internationalist without being interventionist. It's a good idea. But there isn't a very strong historical precedent for it. And, you know, I think some of the errors that followed September 11th and in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are part and parcel of a vision of international leadership that grows very much out of the British self-conception and its own empire. So it's just not as simple as all that.
The United States has to come to terms with what it has done in the world since 1945, and especially since Vietnam. We like to look back on the Second World War and the Civil War as good wars that the United States really more than helped with, were a decisive force in combating great evil. But since 1945, especially since Vietnam and Iraq, we have killed more people in foreign countries than any other nation. We're nowhere near coming to terms with that. And when I hear Adam Schiff say that the Ukrainians are fighting our fight, his exact words, I want to say, as an American citizen, no, they're not. They're not fighting our fight. And shipping weapons to them is not the best thing we can be doing for them or for the world. A negotiated peace on the eastern borders of Ukraine with their important neighbor is the best thing we could hope for. But we're falling into the kind of imperial habits, leaning very heavily on force, which we call democracy, that Burke fought against. So I do think that there's incumbent on us a duty to come to terms with our own history, which we've just barely begun to do.
Andy Bacevich, why do we not feel more, I don't know, custodianship, care, respect for the Afghans, for example, or the Iraqis, not to mention the Vietnamese?
I mean, well, all kinds of, many answers to a good question. One of them, of course, is that the American people have basically disengaged from the wars that are being conducted in their names. And the Washington Post series on Afghanistan reminded readers of the number of Afghans who have been killed, Afghan civilians, Afghan security forces, U.S. forces killed, U.S. forces wounded, a couple $1 trillion spent. But, Joe Blow, who's living in Peoria, unless he has a kid who chose to enlist in the Army or the Marine Corps, Joe's untouched by those events and has other things on his mind. So the American people are not paying attention to these wars. And I think, this deep-seated sense of our calling, our mission to redeem the world, it's hardwired into our collective psyche, provides all kinds of excuses to not take a serious look at our behavior. And as David Bromwich said, in particular, the results of our wars that we've undertaken since 1945, we don't want to think about that.
Is there a retraining course or
what? I don't know. A lot of those kids in Peoria didn't come back. Some of them came back dead of their own hand. More suicides than combat casualties in the war in Iraq. And a lot of them are addicted to something. And people understand it jolly well, Andy, I think. They don't make the connections, all of them, but...
Well, you made the point earlier that in some of those precincts, that's where... Trump attracted a number of his, supporters.
Got it. I got to thank...
lying through his teeth about ending the wars, but nonetheless, he made that case and it helped put him in the White House.
Andy Bacewich, I got to thank you. And David Bromwich in New Haven, Noah Feldman of the Harvard Law School. Thank you all. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of energetic, idea-driven podcasts. This week, try the strange story of New Hampshire's gone but not forgotten old man in the mountain from the producer... Charles Gustin of Iconography. Listen in at iconographypodcast.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.